Good morning, everyone. I just had an opportunity to meet with some of the leadership from my home state of Iowa. You know, this is always a treat for me to come to the FFA convention. These young folks are an extraordinarily impressive group. I can tell you that I speak in a lot of venues, but honestly and truthfully, this is the toughest venue for me to speak because I'm following people who are extraordinarily well-spoken and articulate. I never see notes on the podium. I don't know how these young people can do it, but they don't skip a beat. This is the future of agriculture in my home state. It's the future of agriculture generally, and that future is bright. Over 600,000 members in this organization, both in terms of rural areas and also urban centers as well, covering the gambit of agriculture and agribusiness. A lot of hopes and dreams and aspirations, high aspirations, as they should be. And you know, I think it's important to, for me to talk to the leadership to hear their concerns about whether or not we're going to continue to have enough educators to sponsor chapters, to lead chapters, to provide advice and to be advisors to chapters, whether we're going to continue to have the productivity in American agriculture and global agriculture that will meet the challenges of global food security, whether we can continue to do the job that we've been doing recently of working with and partnership with FFA and other organizations to deal with the hunger issue in the United States. These young people have done a terrific job working with us to expand summer feeding, and as a result of that, we've actually literally fed millions of more meals to young people during the summer months who may not come from backgrounds or from families that may be economically strapped and may not have that meal that they need. So it's just an impressive group, and I'm happy to be here. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. Yes.
Kelsey LaShield, radio reporter for the National FFA. With the ag industry facing so many controversial issues, what advice do you have for FFA members wanting to be an advocate?
Well, I think it's important for the for young people in particular to speak to the 99% of America that doesn't farm. And that's advice I give to every farm organization. I think farm organizations and farmers have a great job of do a great job of talking to each other, and frankly, they sometimes do a good job of arguing with each other. But what we're not doing as much of, and what we need to do more of, is educating the public about the system we have and the benefits that they get from the system. So, for example, I shared earlier today. With young people, the necessity of pointing out to people in the country that they have the freedom to choose occupations and jobs and professions because they don't have to worry about feeding their family. They've delegated that responsibility to a very small percentage of our country. That is often not a focus of the ag message, but it should be because it is actually true. It was not that long ago in this country that if you didn't grow it, you didn't eat. Well, now I've got the freedom to practice law. My kids have the freedom to pursue other careers because we're depending on the next generation of farmers to continue to feed our families. Secondly, I think it is important to point out that Americans have more freedom with their paychecks, not just their opportunity, but also their paychecks and their incomes because we spend so little for our food, relatively speaking. And then I think it is important to point out to all of the country the sacrifices that rural families in particular make. In terms of military service. I think these are three very important messages. Now, why are those messages important? Well, because it establishes a foundation. It lays the groundwork for understanding why we have the agricultural system we have and allows for, I think, a more constructive conversation between those who have concerns about this production method or this issue with pesticides or this issue with science, whatever it might be. If we have that kind of conversation, I think it's a more productive conversation. So that's one piece of advice. The second piece of advice I think is that this generation of Americans has embraced diversity in a far greater way than previous generations, and I think there needs to be an embracing of the notion of diversity within agriculture, diversity in size, diversity in production method, diversity in crop selection, and diversity in operators. I'm concerned that we have not sent a particularly positive message to young women. This organization does. When I meet with the leadership, about 50%, in this case, two-thirds, are young women. But that doesn't necessarily and has not necessarily translated when I meet with boards and commissions of ag groups. It's mostly people that look like me. The future of agriculture is not being as exclusive as that. The future of agriculture is a picture that looks more like this. So it's going to be important, I think, for FFA leadership to continue to be in leadership positions, to continue to be interested and to a certain extent to demand a seat at the table and not just a seat so that you can say, oh, we've got a woman member, but a seat where you're basically feel welcome. So we're working with boards and commissions to try to get that message across, and I think these young people can definitely convey that message because they're comfortable with it. A lot of challenges, no question, but incredible opportunity. This generation of young people in agriculture is going to be able to be the generation that basically does figure out how to feed the world. I mean, not just the folks who are fortunate enough to have access, but to literally deal with the 825 million that aren't getting fed adequately today. They are the generation that will figure out how to deal with a changing climate. They're the generation that will figure out how we can reduce the use of pesticides and herbicides and chemicals, better soil health, better water quality, because these kids are committed to figuring this out. And they're embracing science. They're not afraid of it. So a lot of opportunity here and a lot of message points. Other questions?
Mr. Secretary, Marcus Green with WDRB here in Louisville. There's been a lot of criticism, especially here in Kentucky, about the EPA's proposed water to the U.S. rule. And I'm wondering, do you share any of those concerns that that rule is detrimental to farmers and to a larger extent?
It's a piece of advice. You have a choice between being an EPA administrator and a USDA secretary. You want to be the secretary. That's a tough job, EPA administrator, tough job. You know, I think the process that we have in this country for proposals to be made and then for people to react to those proposals is a healthy one because it gives people the ability to come in and to educate folks about precisely the impact or potential impact or the interpretation of a particular rule that may not have been appreciated, may not have been fully understood, or conversely gives the administration the ability to come in and say, well, no, that's not what we mean. This is what we mean. So I think the conversation that's taken place on the waters of the U.S. has been a healthy one. I think both sides are continuing to be educated. I know the EPA has learned a lot, so let me just take a piece of it. The interpretive guidance, the intent, and I know this for a fact because I talked to Gina McCarthy about this, the intent was actually to create greater certainty for agriculture. The intent was to reassure agriculture that this was not going to extend the jurisdiction, wasn't going to extend the land grab, wasn't going to be something that was onerous. It was really something that was designed to provide help and assistance, to provide clarity. Well, folks in the countryside did not interpret it that way. It's a lesson for EPA. And so I have no doubt that this process will have an impact on what EPA's final decision is going to be. When that's going to happen, I don't know. You know, I think that all of us are concerned about soil health. All of us are concerned about water quality. I think this discussion, unfortunately, has put almost all the spotlight in terms of this rule on agriculture, when in fact we're dealing with a much larger set of contributors to the condition of our waters. And sometimes that too gets lost in the conversation, and I wish that was a more significant point that was made by everyone, that agriculture really, at the end of the day, is a small part of this. There are other contributors, and those other contributors need to step up in a significant way. So I think it's been a healthy conversation. I think EPA has listened. I think they have learned. And I would not be surprised that what they finally do reflects that learning experience. And I hope on the other side that the ag community appreciates the effort that Gina McCarthy individually has made to travel to rural areas, to visit with farm groups, to sit down and talk about the rule. because I think that's a conversation that over time might be beneficial for both the EPA and the ag community.
What are those concerns that the ag community has? Are those down to their own doubt?
I think that there's a legitimate concern about certain aspects of the rule, and I've shared this with Gina, so this is not something that's going to come as a surprise to her. I think there is a concern about the ephemeral stream issue. If it's got a bed, it's got a bank, water runs through it at some point in time, that could potentially be something that's regulated. I think there is deep concern about that, and I think there's legitimate concern, and I think Gina recognizes that. I think the intent is appropriate. I mean, I think we want clean water. We want to make sure that we do what we can. We also want to make sure that ag is not seen as the sole culprit and sole contributor, because it's not. In fact, what we're seeing in the Chesapeake Bay area is we're seeing ag really stepping up in a significant, meaningful way with voluntary conservation. And I think, from my perspective, we want to do more conservation. We have a record number of acres enrolled in conservation now. We want to continue to do more conservation. We want to continue to encourage volunteer conservation because it's working. And we're measuring it, we're verifying it, we're quantifying it. It's working. So hopefully we'll be able to continue to do more of that. Yeah.
Secretary Sarah Wiles, Agri-Pulse. You recently outlined your desire to advance a practice that would stand a lot of the checkoff based on the 96 Act, and that you would soon be perhaps outlining what that might look like and accepting and looking for comments from the community. What kind of timeline are you on in terms of maybe proposing what you're looking for in the checkoff?
Sarah, I think there's an additional step that's going to take place before we outline what we're thinking, and that is to pose a series of questions to producers and producer groups so that we can get their input to formulate. I don't have any preconceived notion as to what this checkoff should look like. So we will be putting in the Federal Register a notice with a series of questions soliciting comment and input from producers and producer groups that will help us formulate what a second checkoff would look like. And honestly, I'm happy to not do this if the folks who have been talking for 3 years could continue to talk and ultimately get to a point where they all agree. That has not happened, unfortunately. The only point of agreement by all of the groups that I've talked to about this, the only point of agreement is we need more money into the system. We need more money to market. We need more money to research. We need more money to promote. And I understand the significance of that for this industry that is challenged at this point in time. Low supply, pretty good prices, domestic consumption challenges, a lot of competition, need to maybe scale that up a little, need to really push the global market opportunities, which are going to be enormous, but you're going to need more resources to do that. And I think it's unfortunate that the lack of the ability of folks in the industry to coalesce around a set of changes and reforms and into the current checkoff prevents us from getting additional money into the system. So absent that agreement, I've got the power to create an avenue for additional money. I'm going to use that power unless the industry comes back and says, you know, you don't have to do that, Mr. Secretary. We've come to an understanding. This is how we would like it done. I'm all for that. But I haven't heard that. What I've heard is we need more money. So absent an agreement, we'll solicit comments, take those comments, shape a proposal. I would imagine that we're looking at something that would be instituted sometime in calendar year 2015. You've got to go through a series of administrative steps. It takes a while, but I'm very intent on getting this done. It'll be in place for a couple years. Then there'll be a referendum. We might learn a little something about what works and what doesn't work, but in the meantime, we're going to be getting more resources into the system. Well, I think the hope is that that gets done in the next couple of weeks.
Mr. Secretary Ron Hayes of Oklahoma City, when you made the APH announcement here just a couple of weeks ago, you indicated that you're not going to, of course, move forward with winter wheat. Since that time, House Ag Committee Chairman, Mr. Lucas, and we'd still like for you to revisit that issue. Are you going to close the door totally on them on that, or is there still some ways to maybe revisit?
Here's the problem. It really is the way in which insurance is written and the way in which premiums are calculated and the way in which actuarially you can determine the soundness of a particular proposal. It's just not going to work for winter wheat because the deadline has passed. The September 30th deadline has passed. Things are kind of locked into the system. And you really, if you go down the road of opening up the system, what's to say you wouldn't open up the system on every circumstance in every situation? That's just not actuarially a good idea. We did what we could do with APH. I feel very strongly about this. Our FSA and RMA folks have worked extraordinarily hard over the last 6 or 7 months. And when I spoke to the chairman and other members of Congress about this, I said, you know, I hope you understand the implementation of this farm bill in the first 6 to 7 months is as good as it has ever been done. We've got the ARC and PLC program out. We've got the disaster payments out. We've made 395,000 payments under disaster assistance, $3.8 billion. We've put the foundation out. We put the RCPP, the Conservation Partnership Program, out. We resumed the trade promotion programs. I mean, there's a whole series of things we've done, and in many cases, the very same people have to sign off on all of this. So it's been a very effective rollout. The fact that we can't satisfy 100% of folks, that's unfortunate, but we have gotten pretty far down the road in terms of satisfying the vast majority of producers. And I just don't see at this point, based on what I've been told, in terms of the actuarial soundness of the decisions that RMA has to make, that they would be in a position to be able to reopen. The companies themselves, are not as happy about this APH announcement as some of the producers are. This is enormously complicated. I don't think anybody realizes how many calculations go into this APH, because you basically have a 10-year window. And depending upon your farm and depending upon the crops that you raise in the farm, you have different calculations for each one of those crops. And if you decide to eliminate a year, it may be necessary for you to go back beyond the 10-year time frame. In fact, in some scenarios, you may have to go all the way back to the 1980s to get the information to do the appropriate calculation. And if you're in a county where corn qualifies, but soybeans don't, but because a contiguous county, soybeans count, but corn doesn't, you're in a county that both corn and soybeans count, just to use an Iowa example. Very complicated. And I think it's easy for folks to say, hey, do this, get this done, until you realize how complicated it is and you realize what kind of financial calculations go into setting premiums and setting coverages. It's just not going to work for winter wheat, as difficult as it may be for those producers. But for all the other producers of major commodities, they are going to get some relief, and we're happy to do it because our folks worked overtime. They worked on Saturdays. They worked late at night. They got 2 months ahead on RMA and crop insurance programs. They were able to use the ARC and PLC calculations to cut time, and they had additional staffing. So I think they did a heck of a job. Well, I'm obviously pleased that we're not confronted with a situation where Mexico would feel compelled to retaliate against, a number of other products, some of which are Iowa-based and other states. It's still in the process of all the details and all that stuff being worked out, but I'm happy that we were able to avoid the kind of harm that could come from a tit-for-tat kind of situation and scenario. Mexico is a very important customer for us, and we're a very important customer for them. I've developed a very close relationship with Secretary Martinez, and I want to maintain and continue that relationship because I think it's good for agriculture on both sides of the border. So I'm pleased that they were able to get this done. All right, thank you all. So...